This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Hidden Order by Brad Thor. Read by Armin Schultz.
Prologue. Sea Island, Georgia. Claire Marcourt should have gone to bed hours ago. She should have ignored the second bottle of white burgundy in the fridge, placed her empty wine glass in the sink, and headed upstairs. But the 45-year-old was feeling nostalgic, and the more she drank, the more nostalgic she became. Picking up the bottle, she stepped outside. The night was warm, and the ocean air carried with it the scent of magnolias. Just beyond her pool, foamy waves tumbled onto the quiet beach. Her pool. It was hard for Claire Marcourt to believe how far one family could come in a generation. Her mother had cleaned houses on Sea Island. Now Claire owned one and was being considered for one of the most powerful positions in the world. Only in America, she thought to herself. It was heartbreaking that her mother hadn't lived to see everything Claire had accomplished. Her career, her handsome husband, and their three beautiful children. The Sea Island house with its stately oaks covered in Spanish moss. All of it. She would have been so proud. As it was, she hadn't even seen Claire graduate from college. Cancer had taken her, and in its wake, had left Claire with a growing fear that she too might someday be prematurely taken from her family. Pouring another glass, she set the bottle on the outdoor table and walked to the edge of the patio. She was becoming maudlin. Focusing on the ocean, she took a long sip and closed her eyes. As the waves rolled onto the beach, she reflected on what a blessing it was to be able to come back to Georgia and escape the sirens and traffic of Manhattan. The family didn't get down to Sea Island enough these days. Everyone was so busy. The funny thing, though, was that once Paul and the kids were here, no one wanted to leave. She couldn't blame them. The island was for them not only a source of strength, but also of revival. It was the one place where they all felt truly at home, truly safe. Listening to the waves, she was reminded of a poem about the area by Sidney Lanier called The Marshes of Glynn. Take courage from the land which God has given you, which has always nourished you, and which is still there, and be comforted. Claire smiled and opened her eyes. Her budding melancholy swept out to sea on a receding wave. She needed to think about that poem and this place more often. Work had all but consumed her, and it wasn't going to get any easier if things went in the direction she thought they were about to. Draining the last of the wine from her glass, she stood there admiring the power of the ocean for a moment, lost in her own thoughts. She never noticed the figure that stepped out of the darkness and onto her patio. He was powerful and moved quickly, clamping a gloved hand over her mouth. Before she knew what had happened, she felt a prick, almost like being stung, and her body went limp. She not only couldn't move a muscle, she couldn't make a sound. The man removed his hand from her mouth, bent down, and slung her over his shoulder. She could feel her heart pounding in her chest. "What is going on?" she screamed in the silence of her mind. "Why me? What does he want? Where is he taking me?" It didn't take long for her last question to be answered. Staring down past the man's dark trousers and thick black boots, she could see the flagstone path turn to sand. He was taking her to the beach. "Why the beach? Does he need some isolated spot where he can do whatever it is he's going to do to me?" A couple of hundred yards away, Claire began to see the outline of something else, and her heart began to pound even faster. Pulled up onto the beach was an inflatable gray Zodiac boat. Claire was deathly afraid of open water, particularly the open ocean. It was one thing to have a house on the coast with a view of the ocean. It was something entirely different to be out on the water. But Claire had no choice in what was about to happen. Laying her down inside the Zodiac, the man pulled the bow around and dragged the boat into the ocean. She could feel the moment it was floated and lifted up off the sand. A wave of nausea swept over her, and she wanted to throw up, but her body didn't comply. It was as if it weren't even her body anymore, as if she were in a coma and no one knew she was actually awake. As her attacker climbed into the boat and started its engine, Claire's fear of the open ocean was replaced by another fear, or, more properly stated, a resignation. Whoever this man was, and whatever his intent, she was never going to see her family again. 7 miles south, the Zodiac entered St. Simon Sound and continued on. At the tip of a narrow point of wooded land was the entrance to a small winding creek. The man killed the main engine and switched to a smaller, quieter motor. There could be no witnesses. His assignment was almost complete. By the time anyone realized Claire Marcourt was missing, the plan would already be unrolling, and there'd be nothing anyone could do. He glanced down at the woman as he removed a weatherized iridium satellite phone and dialed a string of digits. When the call was answered, he identified himself.
"Hotel Sierra?" a man's voice asked on the other end.
They spoke in code, using the military alphabet. Hotel represented the letter H, which in this communication stood for hostage. Sierra stood for S, as in secure.
"Affirmative. Hotel Sierra."
"ID Lima."
"Identify location."
"Lima 3,
the man in the Zodiac replied, indicating he had arrived at the creek.
"Roger. Lima 3, the voice replied. "Charlie Mike."
"Continue mission."
"Roger. Charlie Mike."
With those words, Claire Marcourt's fate was sealed, and the rest of the operation was officially set in motion. Chapter 1. Lufthansa First Class Lounge, Frankfurt Airport, Germany. Lydia Ryan looked up from her tablet as a waiter set a drink in front of her.
"I didn't order this," she said.
"No, ma'am," replied the waiter. "It is from the gentleman."
Ryan shut down the tablet and cautiously glanced around the sleek, chrome and leather accented room. She didn't see anyone looking back at her.
"What gentleman?"
As the waiter smiled, a man seated in the area behind her said,
"This gentleman."
Ryan recognized the voice almost immediately.
"May I join you?"
he asked, as she turned around to face him. Before she could respond, the man had already stood, his own drink in hand, and was walking around to her. While paths did sometimes cross in the intelligence world, Ryan knew better than to believe in coincidences. The fact that she and Nafi Naziri, deputy chief of the Jordanian General Intelligence Department, were in the same airport lounge was no accident. He was in his late 40s, tall, with medium-length black hair and refined, handsome features. He came from a wealthy family related to the king and had been educated in England and the United States. He had a penchant for dark Italian suits, and his shoes were always highly polished. On his left wrist, he wore the same elegant Patek Philippe watch that Ryan remembered.
"It's good to see you again, Lydia,"
he said, as he set a briefcase down and took the seat facing her.
"It's been a long time, Nafi."
"Even so, you haven't changed at all. You're still as beautiful as ever."
"Still the player," she thought to herself, as she smiled and shook her head.
"How's the shoulder?"
she asked, beating him to the punch. Reaching across his body, he massaged his right shoulder.
"I find the changes in barometric pressure difficult, particularly before it rains."
3 years ago, Naziri had knocked her to the ground as a suicide bomber was about to detonate. He had taken shrapnel in his upper arm and had used the injury ever since as an attempt to guilt her into sleeping with him.
"That's too bad. I guess it's a good thing you live in the desert, huh?
Naziri smiled. He had worked with multiple female intelligence agents over the years and had been able to break all of them down. All of them, except Ryan. She was like no woman he had ever met. The stunning product of a Greek mother and Irish father, she was tall, at least 5'10", with a mane of thick dark hair, framing an aristocratic face illuminated by two large deep green eyes. The fact that she had never said yes to him made him want her all the more. She was also a highly adept field operative. Despite only being in her early 30s, she had proven herself on multiple occasions to be just as courageous, just as skilled, and just as deadly as her male counterparts. He could only imagine how exceptional she would be in bed. Ryan took notice of him drinking her in with his eyes and decided to cut to the chase.
What are the odds that you and I would both be passing through Frankfurt?
Naziri smiled.
I needed to see you.
So this isn't fate, then?
She replied, pursing her lips in a disappointed pout.
Unfortunately, no,
he said, his buoyant casual demeanor gone. His tone now was more professional, almost urgent.
May we speak someplace more discreet? He continued.
I've reserved one of the private conference rooms for us.
What's going on, Nafi?
Please, he said, standing.
I was going to get something to eat before my flight.
There is already food in the room.
Ryan had no idea what this was about, but he had definitely piqued her curiosity.
Well, seeing as how you've gone to so much trouble, how could a lady say no?
Gathering up her belongings, the pair made their way toward the conference room. Once inside, Naziri closed the drapes as Ryan perused the assortment of appetizers that had been laid out. She prepared a plate of food and, after looking at the available beverages, poured herself a glass of mineral water. Wine was out of the question. She liked Naziri, but she wasn't going to let her guard down around him. On the airplane back home, she could have a couple of glasses of wine if she wanted. Right now, she intended to be all business. After sitting down, she placed her napkin in her lap and had just taken a bite of smoked duck when Naziri took the chair across from her and, apropos of nothing, asked,
"Is Jordan next on your list?"
She had no idea what he was talking about. Swallowing her food, she said,
"Excuse me?
Is Jordan next?"
"I don't understand. Next for what?"
"Come on, Lydia," Naziri replied. "We know each other well enough. We've seen some very bad things together. We shouldn't play games."
"Nafi, no one is playing games here. You need to be specific with me. What are you talking about?"
Reaching down, he removed a folder from his briefcase and slid it across the conference table.
"These pictures were taken 3 days ago."
Now, he really had piqued her interest. Moving her plate aside, she drew the folder to her and flipped it open. The exhalation of breath that escaped her lips, as well as the word shit upon seeing the first of the photos, was both unintentional and unprofessional.
"I guess we don't need to argue whether or not those are your former teammates?"
They were, in fact, old teammates of hers. They had been part of a covert program that specialized in orchestrating social, political, and organizational instability abroad. Their primary expertise was in the Muslim world. In addition to developing elaborate plots designed to create chaos inside organizations like Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Hamas, Al-Shabaab, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, they had also been active in the rendering of terrorists to disavowed black sites under the continuation of America's supposedly discontinued Extraordinary Rendition Program. In the program, codenamed Eclipse, the CIA team had broken every rule in the book, and the more rules they broke, the more successes they racked up. It was a self-perpetuating cycle that had turned the team into success addicts, and, like real addicts, they kept searching for bigger and bigger highs by going after bigger targets and launching more audacious operations. In the team members' minds, they could do no wrong. The funny thing about believing you can do no wrong is that you quickly begin doing nothing but wrong. It had started with small infractions as standards slipped, such as getting sloppy with reporting or sneaking alcohol along on ops. From there, it grew into misappropriating agency assets, like Black Hawk helicopters for bighorn sheep hunts in the Hindu Kush, all the way to some members of the co-ed team developing off-limits personal relationships and sleeping with each other. These were men and women whose reputations on the covert side of the intelligence community were quickly outstripping their actual abilities. They were the CIA's golden children, a mixture of analysts and gunslingers who had not only started believing their own press releases, but in the deadly fog of the global war on terror had begun to see themselves as almost immortal. They were careening toward a cliff with no one to pump the brakes. That was precisely when fate stepped in. Without the knowledge of the Italian government, they had attempted to snatch a high-ranking Al-Qaeda member off the streets of Rome, and a shootout had erupted. Associates of the terrorist had opened fire, killing five Italian citizens, two of them police officers. It was the end of the Eclipse program. All of the members had been cut loose from the Central Intelligence Agency. All of them, that is, but Lydia Ryan.
"Where were these pictures taken?" she asked.
"Cyprus."
"And you said 3 days ago?"
"Yes," replied Naziri. "The only person missing is you."
"I have nothing to do with them anymore."
"But that's your old team, is it not?" he asked.
"Sure, but all of them were cut loose. You know that."
"Do I? I'm not so sure anymore. The CIA didn't cut you loose, did they?"
"That's different," Ryan argued.
He leaned back in his chair, unconvinced.
"Really? Different how?"
"I was assigned to police that team. They were good. But they were also a bunch of cowboys. People don't last long at Langley if you don't follow the rules."
"Interesting. I seem to remember you breaking a lot of the rules yourself."
"No," Ryan admonished him. "What you remember is an imbecile of a CIA station chief and an American ambassador with a Pollyannish worldview. Everything we did, everything, there was clearance for, especially the things we kept quiet from those two. It's hard enough doing the work you and I do without having to fight our own people in the process."
Naziri shrugged. "I guess I'll have to take your word for it."
She looked at him.
"What the hell is that supposed to mean?"
"It means, my dear Lydia, that even by your own admission, your destabilization team was very skilled. Yet despite that skill, someone chose to shut it down and fire all of its members. All the members, that is, except for you. If I recall correctly, you got promoted. Case officer now, isn't it?"
Glancing at her watch, Ryan said,
"If there's a point to all of this, Nafi, I suggest you get to it."
"The point is that your entire CIA destabilization team, minus your policing presence, was seen in Cyprus 3 days ago, meeting with two men that my country is very nervous about."
"These two?"
she asked, pointing at one of the photographs.
"Who are they?"
"Senior members of the Jordanian Muslim Brotherhood."
Suddenly it hit her.
"Wait a second. You think that the United States is planning to topple Jordan?"
Naziri raised his hands, palms up, and tilted his head to the side.
"If you were in our position, with governments falling all around you, what would you think?"
"I think a country like Jordan should be confident enough to trust its allies. That's what I think."
The Jordanian leaned forward and repeated his original question.
"Is Jordan going to be the next Middle Eastern country to be overthrown?"
"There could be any number of reasons for that meeting in Cyprus."
"Really?" he stated, reaching down and removing two more folders from his briefcase. He held them out over the table and then let them drop.
"Would any of those reasons be the same or different for why your team was seen in both Egypt and Libya before those governments collapsed?"
She would have stressed again that it wasn't her team, but she was too stunned by his remarks to utter the words. The Americans in those photos had not only been let go from the CIA, they had been let go with prejudice, along with big black marks in their records.
What was this all about?
Lydia Ryan was good at reading people, so whatever intelligence Nafi Naziri had, she could see he was 100% confident in it, which meant, by extension, so was his boss, and very likely, the King of Jordan himself. Otherwise, Nafi wouldn't have been sent here to meet with her like this.
"I don't know what to say," she finally offered.
The Jordanian pushed the folders across the table to her.
"Tell me you'll read what's in these files."
"Of course, but..."
"And that you'll get me some answers."
"Nafi, I can't make you any promises."
Naziri looked at her, his face implacable. Reaching down, he removed a final folder from his briefcase, but he didn't open it. He didn't push it across the table either. He just sat there, tapping his index finger on the cover.
"I'm sorry to have to do this," he finally said.
"Sorry for what?"
"Understand that we take any threat to the survival of the Kingdom of Jordan very seriously."
There was now another tone in his voice, and she didn't like it.
"What's in the folder, Nafi?"
The Jordanian lifted the cover, but only high enough so that he could see inside. From where she was sitting, Ryan couldn't make out a thing.
"Over the winter, we infiltrated a terror cell that has been moving bomb makers, bomb materials, and martyrs into Syria via Lebanon. While inside the cell, our asset learned of an advanced plot targeting the United States."
Ryan's eyes went wide.
"You've known of an attack being mounted against the United States, and this is the first you're telling us? Give me that file. I want to see what's in it."
Naziri shook his head.
"We've been monitoring the situation."
"Monitoring the situation? My ass," said Ryan, her anger growing. "You know what, Nafi? Fuck you, and fuck your monitoring. You can't sit on information like that."
"We didn't want to come to you until we were confident."
"This is blackmail. The Kingdom of Jordan is blackmailing the United States. That's what's going on here. You're not going to give me what I want until you get what you want."
The Jordanian slid the file back into his briefcase and stood. Ryan's blood was boiling. She knew her emotions were getting the better of her, and that that was wrong, but she couldn't control her anger.
"You haven't given me a shred of proof. What makes you think my superiors will even believe you?"
Naziri frowned as he reached the conference room door.
"I think a country like America should be confident enough to trust its allies. That's what I think. Have a good flight home, Lydia."
With that, the Jordanian was gone, and in his wake, the CIA had been dropped into a nightmare involving a terrorist plot that might or might not exist, and no way to even begin running it to ground. Chapter 2. Coast of Somalia. Monday. From the beginning, everyone had told Scott Harvath that his plan not only was flawed and would never work, but was absolutely insane. The three men who disagreed had been hired on the spot. Parachuting onto the rear deck of the supertanker Sienna Star was considered a kamikaze mission, but they'd made it. One of the team members was injured on the landing, but they still managed to retake the ship and free its crew. What they hadn't bargained for, though, was that the tanker's captain had been smuggled to shore earlier as an insurance policy against any such rescue attempt. This had placed Harvath and his team in a very difficult position. The assignment called for the successful recapture of the ship and the recovery of the entire crew. In order to beat out the other private contractors for the job, Harvath's boss had proposed an exorbitant fee, but with the caveat that the ship's owners owed them nothing unless the operation was 100% successful. As a former Navy SEAL with a storied career, now working for a private intelligence agency, he lived for this kind of work. That said, it was an extremely risky operation, and it wasn't the first they had been forced to take. Recently, his employer and the company's namesake, Reed Carlton, had been targeted for assassination. The killers had also targeted the Carlton Group's top operations personnel. Harvath and Carlton had been lucky enough to survive, but they had lost so many key players that their organization was unable to function at its previous level, and ended up losing its biggest and sole government contract with the Defense Department. Because of that loss, they had been forced to take any and all assignments, sometimes under ridiculous terms, in order to rebuild their organization. The old man, as Harvath referred to Carlton, had put everything on the line for this assignment, advancing a small fortune that included funding a secondary team out in the Gulf of Aden to conduct drone reconnaissance on the Sienna Star for the last week and a half. Despite this surveillance, though, no one had realized that the pirates had smuggled the captain off the tanker. It wasn't until Harvath and his team had retaken the ship that they discovered his absence. At that point, they were left with only one option. They had to recover him. Their hope was that the last thing the pirates would ever expect was that their pursuers would risk following them to their own village. As was typical with Somalis, the pirates had imported engineers, mostly from Kenya, who could operate the hijacked vessels until their owners, or more often their insurance companies, paid whatever ransom was being asked for. In the case of the Sienna Star, though, the tanker's navigator had been murdered in the initial throes of the hijacking, and the ship's owners wanted to send a message. They wanted all of the pirates killed. Considering that the Somalis had murdered a crew member, Harvath didn't have a problem with that. If any of them posed a threat, they'd be dealt with accordingly. That was exactly how his team had handled retaking the ship. The Kenyan engineer recruited by the pirates was another matter entirely. Not only had he been helpful on board the Sienna Star, but Mukami had assisted Harvath in drawing up a rescue plan for the captain. He knew where the pirates were holding him, and had even offered to take Harvath there, if the price was right. Harvath had agreed to his terms. Mukami had come up with the idea to turn the tables on the pirates by hijacking their own supply boat when it came out to resupply the tanker with food, water, and fresh cot. In addition to getting paid, the man had requested only one additional item. He had asked that his cousin Pili, also an engineer from Kenya, and who would be coming out on the resupply boat, not be harmed. Harvath had agreed to that as well. Leaving their injured colleague plus an additional man behind to hold the Sienna Star, Harvath and his remaining teammate, a former SEAL named Matt Sanchez, used a smiling and waving Mukami as bait and successfully took the pirates' resupply boat when it pulled up alongside the tanker. Within seconds of the three dead Somalis being tossed out of the resupply boat, the great white sharks that infested the Gulf of Aden tore the corpses to shreds. Mukami's cousin, Pili, simply thought he was coming out to take over the Sienna Star for a few days. The shooting of the three pirates had taken him completely by surprise. He was in a state of quasi-shock, and so Mukami piloted the resupply boat into port. As Harvath and Sanchez checked and cleaned their weapons, they went over the plan with Mukami once more. They would berth at the northern end of the small harbor where the supply boats normally picked up and dropped off. The car Pili and Mukami shared was already there waiting. While Pili stayed with the boat, Mukami would drive Harvath and Sanchez past the house the pirates owned in order to give them a quick look. He would then drop them off around the corner and continue on to the house himself. It wasn't unusual for the Kenyan engineer, upon arriving back in port, to show up at the walled compound to be paid before proceeding on to his hotel. Usually, the pirates invited him to drink, smoke the hookah, and gamble with them. If they did so tonight, Harvath had told him to accept their offer. Mukami was carrying a satellite phone Harvath had given him, along with a plausible excuse for it. If the phone was discovered, he would state that the Sienna Star was experiencing an electrical issue and that he needed to be available should his cousin require technical assistance. Once inside, Mukami was to try to ascertain where the Greek captain was being held and transmit that information to Harvath and Sanchez. The two former SEALs would handle the rest. When they were done going over the operation, Harvath had a personal question for Mukami.
Why?
What do you mean, why?
The Kenyan replied.
Why do all this? Why work with the pirates?
For the same reason everyone else does. For money.
But the pirates are bad people.
Unfortunately in Africa, said Mukami, we don't have the luxury of deciding from whom we take our money.
But you and your cousin seem like good guys. You're educated, you're polite, you speak multiple languages. For men like you, there have to be other ways to make money.
No, not true. Not for the kind of money we need.
I don't understand, said Harbeth.
My sister and Peely's sister went abroad. They paid bad men to smuggle them into Europe. They were told they would be given jobs and would be starting over with an opportunity for a better life. It was a lie. They were trafficked. That was 2 years ago. We have not seen or heard from them since. The men tell us that for more money, they can get our sisters back. This is why we have been working for anyone who will pay us, and pay us well.
It was one of the millions of heartbreaking stories that existed throughout the Third World. It was also none of his business, and Harvath was sorry he'd asked. A hush fell over the boat, and there was only the sound of the diesel engines as they made their way toward shore. When the resupply boat pulled into the pirate's port, it was well past midnight. The pier they tied up to was completely deserted, except for a few other supply boats, their crews long since returned home for the evening. On the other side of the tiny harbor, they could see a stem-to-stern string of pirate motherships and fast attack boats. While Somali piracy may have been down overall, this village still seemed to be making a very good living at it. Peering out of the boat's wheelhouse, Harbeth and Sanchez took one last look up and down the pier, before allowing Mokami to disembark and ready his vehicle. Peely would stay aboard and wait for everyone to return. They watched Mokami walk down the dock to a battered brown Mercedes sedan with one white door and a missing rear window. Once the car was fired up and running, he turned the lights off and then back on to signal the coast was clear. After one more thorough look around the harbor, Harbath and Sanchez stepped out of the wheelhouse and onto the dock. Though they had taken steps to disguise themselves with Somali clothing they'd found aboard the Sienna Star, they would never fool anyone up close. That was fine by both men, though, as they didn't plan to get personal with anyone other than the people they intended to kill. As soon as his passengers were inside the car, Mokami turned onto a side street and made for the pirate's stronghold. He knew better than to drive up the narrow main drag. The village wasn't very big, but judging from the satellite dishes clustered on the rooftops, as well as the expensive foreign cars parked in front of some rather impressive compounds, Harbath's opinion about the profitability of the local piracy trade had been right on the money. Mokami slowed as they approached one such stronghold and told Harbath and Sanchez it was coming up on the left. Music could be heard from inside, and lights could be seen from the upper windows. There were no guards in front, which Sanchez immediately remarked upon.
They're pirates, replied Mokami. They have many, many guns. Who would be dumb enough to steal from them?
Just because it hadn't ever happened didn't mean it wouldn't, and the fact that even Somalis suffered from normalcy bias made Harvath shake his head. The pirates were about to learn a very painful and hopefully very expensive lesson. Pulling around the block, Mokami dropped his passengers at an abandoned fisherman's shack, its windows missing and its roof caved in.
You know what to do? Harbath asked.
Mokami nodded, and before Harbath could ask another question, drove off. Sanchez watched the old Mercedes recede into the darkness.
Do you think he can keep his shit together?
Harbath nodded.
He's nervous, but I've made it worth his while. He'll do it. Let's get inside.
The two men hid themselves in the dilapidated dwelling and waited. 20 minutes later, they received a text message from Mokami. The captain was at the compound and was being kept in a room on the first floor. There were at least 30 men inside. Sanchez let out a quiet whistle.
30. That's a lot of manskirts. That's a lot of guns. And RPGs. And RPGs,
Harbath agreed.
Let's see if we can peel some of them off. Ready?
Sanchez nodded as Harbath switched frequencies on his radio to hail the heavily armed support boat that had been doing the reconnaissance on the tanker. It was now hovering just out of sight offshore.
Shotgun, This is Norseman. Do you copy? Over.
A moment later, the response came back. Norseman, this is Shotgun. We copy. Over.
You are cleared hot. I repeat, you are cleared hot. Bring the rain. Over.
Roger that, Norseman. Shotgun is cleared hot. Bringing the rain. 90 seconds. Shotgun out. Looking at Sanchez, Harvath said,
Beers are on me when we're done.
Sanchez smiled.
Roger that. Let's roll.
Chapter 3 Harvath and Sanchez stepped from the shack and listened. They were close enough that they could hear the RPGs as they began to be fired from the shotgun team on board the support boat. They could feel the ground tremble as one after another of the motherships and their fast attack craft down at the port exploded. Instantly, the village erupted in pandemonium. Harvath and Sanchez took advantage of the mayhem to advance unseen on the pirate stronghold. They held up behind a parked car and watched as at least 20 men poured out of the compound and rushed down to the harbor. They gave it another 60 seconds, and when no one else came out, they decided to go in. The gate had been left wide open, and Harvath slipped inside first, followed by Sanchez. They split the pie, with Harvath engaging two pirates to the left and Sanchez one to the right. Utilizing speed, surprise, and overwhelming violence of action, they kept moving and firing as they pressed on into the main structure. From inside the house, a frightened Somali hopped up on cot, began firing before the two Americans had even neared the door. As Harvath returned fire with a suppressed MP7, Sanchez flanked the Somali and shot him through a window, killing him instantly. Entering the structure, the firefight continued as three Somalis on a balcony overlooking the living room fired on them. This time, it was Sanchez who returned fire, while Harvath attempted to maneuver for a cleaner shot. The only problem was, he couldn't get one. From their high ground position, the Somalis had total control of the room, and they knew it. Harvath searched for a way to take them out, and then it came to him. Signaling Sanchez, he counted to three and then charged across the living room. While Sanchez kept them pinned down, unable to return fire, Harvath slipped beneath the wooden balcony, pointed his weapon straight up, and fired. The high-velocity rounds of the MP7 tore through the planks, chewing the pirates above to bits. As soon as Sanchez gave him the all-clear, he stepped from under the balcony and moved back across the living room. There were two hallways available to them, and Harvath was about to suggest they take the one to the right when two more skinnies popped out of a room at the end of the hall to their left. He and Sanchez dropped both Somalis instantly. Hoping that was the room where the captain of the Sienna Star was being held, Harvath and Sanchez moved quickly for it. At the door, Sanchez reached for the knob, and when Harvath nodded, threw it open. Inside, they found the last remaining Somali pirate, along with two other men, the Greek tanker captain, and the Kenyan engineer who had led them into the village. The satellite phone Harvath had given him was sitting in his lap, and pressed against Mukami's head was the barrel of the pirate's AK-47. Before Harvath could shout, "Wait!" urge calm, or even get off a shot of his own, the pirate pulled his trigger, and the air was filled with a pink mist as the wall beyond the bed was splattered with blood, bone, and pieces of Mukami's brain. As the Kenyan engineer's body fell to the ground, Harvath unloaded his weapon into the Somali pirate. He didn't stop until his magazine was empty.
"Damn it," he said. "Damn it, damn it, damn it!"
Sanchez didn't reply. There was nothing he could say. Instead, he turned and faced the hallway to make sure they didn't get ambushed from behind. As he tried to get his anger under control, Harvath stepped forward and picked up the radio. Putting his game face back on, he looked at the Greek captain and said,
"Captain Velopoulos, we're here to take you home. Please stay as close to us as possible and do exactly as we say. Do you understand?"
The captain nodded, and after retrieving Mukami's car keys, Harvath and Sanchez moved the Greek quickly out of the building and into the courtyard. While Sanchez stepped out to study the street beyond the wall, Harvath radioed the shotgun team, giving them a description of the Mercedes they'd be driving, as well as their ETA to the harbor.
"Roger that, Norseman," came the response. "We'll see you in the port in 2 minutes. Shotgun out."
They laid the captain down on the floor in back, while Harvath drove and Sanchez rode in the passenger seat. It took only half a block until they began to see the flames from the burning boats down in the harbor climbing high into the night sky.
"They're not going to be very happy to see us when we get there," Sanchez said.
Harvath, still upset about the Kenyan being killed, pressed down hard on the accelerator and replied, "Fuck them." Sanchez nodded and activated his radio.
"Shotgun, this is Streak. ETA to exfil point 60 seconds. Over."
"Roger that, Streak. Be advised, the port is crawling with skinnies. Over."
"Understood. Just be there. Over."
"We'll be there. Don't worry. Shotgun out."
Sanchez looked at Harvath.
"You ready for this?"
Harvath gripped the steering wheel tighter.
"Just watch."
The Mercedes came screaming down the narrow main street into the port. As people ran in every direction, Harvath leaned on the horn to move them out of his path. While it might have been the somewhat humane thing to do, it also succeeded in drawing a hell of a lot of attention, particularly from the pirates gathered on the beach, who were watching their ships burn. After glancing into the back seat, Sanchez said,
"I hope our passenger has comfortable shoes. It's going to be a long walk from the parking lot."
"Who says we're stopping in the parking lot?" replied Harvath,
as he pointed the Mercedes toward the dock and picked up even more speed.
"You've got to be kidding,"
Sanchez began, but was interrupted by a hail of gunfire that tore up their right rear quarter panel. As the Mercedes barreled through a stack of crates at the front of the pier, Sanchez returned fire at the heavily armed Somalis on the beach. Activating his radio, he said,
"Shotgun, shotgun, this is Streak. We have contact. Multiple armed skinnies on the beach. You are cleared hot. We need you now. Over."
"Roger that, Streak. Shotgun coming up on your 3 o'clock.
Before breaking transmission, Sanchez and Harvath looked over to see the shotgun team and their boat come almost parallel with them out on the water and open up on the men on the beach via a devastating minigun mounted on the bow of their boat. Racing down the dock, Harvath brought the Mercedes skidding to a stop next to the resupply boat and leapt out. Taking cover, he aimed his MP7 toward the end of the pier and instructed Sanchez to get the tanker captain out of the car and onto the boat. Once the captain was safely on board, Sanchez returned with a rag that had been soaked in some sort of chemical. After opening the Mercedes gas cap, he shoved it halfway in, removed a lighter, and ignited what was hanging out, saying to Harvath,
"Let's get the hell out of here."
The two men untied the resupply boat and jumped on. As soon as Peely saw that Harvath and Sanchez were aboard and they were clear of the pier, he spun the craft around and made for the mouth of the harbor. The shotgun team was right behind and covered their 6 o'clock all the way out. The last thing any of them saw were the few surviving pirates who foolishly rushed down the dock firing wildly from their AK-47s. One of them even took a knee, mounted an RPG on his shoulder, and was just about to fire when the Mercedes exploded, taking the pier and everything else with it. Chapter 4. Having reinstated Captain Velopoulos and debriefed the crew, Harvath and his team scuttled their weapons and slipped off the Sienna Star about 45 minutes before Interpol boarded near the Kenyan port of Mombasa. They were met by a crooked customs official, arranged for by the old man. He stamped their passports and directed them to a waiting vehicle, which drove them to the airport. The only deviation from their departure plan was that instead of flying home commercially with his teammates, Harvath was now going back via a private jet that was already waiting for him. Carlton was reluctant to give him many details, even over an encrypted satellite phone. He simply said he needed Harvath back as quickly as possible. Harvath knew better than to question him. The old man was a legend in the espionage business. With more than 3 decades at the CIA, he had helped establish the agency's counterterrorism center before retiring and starting his own private enterprise. If he said he needed him back right away, he needed him back right away. While Harvath didn't like the idea of not personally seeing his team safely out of the country, they were all exceptional operators and big boys who could handle clearing passport control and getting on the correct flight. It goes without saying that they hazed Harvath for having his own private jet and being too good to fly commercial with them. It was nothing more than male chop-busting. None of the men held it against him. They understood that in this line of work, time wasn't only money. It could mean the difference between saving or losing lives. Consoling himself with the fact that all his guys had flown private at some point in their lives, that thought quickly faded as he cleared passport control, walked out onto the tarmac, and saw his plane. While his men may have flown private before, he was pretty confident none of them had ever flown like this. Even Harvath, who had gotten used to being moved from country to country on high-end private jets from Gulfstreams, Cessnas, and Hawkers, to Bombardiers, Dassaults, and Embraers, had never seen anything like it. With its long pointed nose and swept back wings, the Ariane supersonic business jet resembled a smaller, futuristic Concorde that had been designed for private use. A pilot, co-pilot, and flight attendant were waiting at the base of the air stairs. They introduced themselves, and the captain gave Harvath a quick tour of the aircraft's exterior. Designed by an American aerospace firm in Reno, Nevada, the Ariane SBJ had a maximum speed of Mach 1.8, or 1,186 miles per hour, and a range of up to 5,300 miles. The captain explained that while over the water, their maximum supersonic cruise speed would be Mach 1.6, but over land, they would have to slow to just under Mach 1.2 in order to continue supersonic travel, but without the boom, or boomless, as he put it. The man was full of interesting information and told Harvath everything except to whom the $90 million aircraft belonged. It sure didn't belong to the old man, but it was obviously somehow connected to the reason Carlton needed him back in D.C. as quickly as possible. As the captain rejoined the co-pilot to complete his pre-flight check, Harvath was handed off to the flight attendant. She was an attractive redhead named Natalie. Her English was excellent, but he picked up on her Swedish accent immediately. His call sign of Norseman wasn't given to him because he looked like some sort of Viking. In fact, with his brown hair and blue eyes, he looked more German than anything else. The Norseman call sign came from his early days in the SEALs, when he had dated a string of Scandinavian Airlines flight attendants. What had started as a good-natured joke had stuck with him throughout his career. He didn't have any complaints, though. There were much worse things an operator could be named for. Natalie escorted him up the stairs and into the aircraft. It was luxuriously appointed with large leather seats and intricate burled wood accents. At just over 6.5 feet wide and 30 feet long, the cabin more than accommodated the 5-foot-10-inch Harvath. After showing him the galley, the lavatory, and the area at the rear of the aircraft that could be closed off for a private sleeping compartment, Natalie offered him something to drink. He smiled to himself as he thought about how many buddies of his got on a plane like this and went right for the top shelf of the bar, either because they were insecure and wanted to appear like they belonged on a private jet, or because they wanted to take advantage of whoever was footing the bill. That wasn't his style. He was more than comfortable in his own skin and didn't give a damn what anyone thought of him. He also knew well enough that the aircraft wouldn't be provisioned with anything its owners didn't want him to enjoy. Having been in the mood for a beer for over a week, that was exactly what he asked for.
"A beer drinker," Natalie replied with a smile. "I like that."
Harvath watched as she turned and walked up the aisle toward the galley. There was nothing like a woman in uniform, particularly a flight attendant's uniform. The scarf tied around the neck was always the coup de grace for him. It radiated a confidence and sexiness that got him every time. When Natalie returned with his drink, she explained the meal services, the in-flight entertainment options, and also handed him an iPad that was wirelessly connected to the plane's satellite internet system. He didn't plan on watching any movies. He planned on sleeping. Before disembarking the Siena Star, he had grabbed a quick shower and shaved, but that was it. It had been more than 24 hours since he had last slept. Knowing the old man the way he did, he was going to be expected to hit the ground running when the plane landed, so now was the time to get some rest. Once the plane had taken off and had reached its cruising altitude, Natalie served Harvath a quick meal and then prepared the sleeping area. Despite how incredibly well insulated and quiet the aircraft was, she had left a pair of earplugs, along with an eye mask and a pair of silk pajamas. Thanking her, Harvath stepped inside and slid the doors closed behind him. He wasn't a pajamas kind of guy. Hanging up his clothes, he slid between the sheets and closed his eyes. He was still wound up, and no sooner had his eyes shut than a picture of Mukami, getting his brains blown out, floated across his mind. He had to force himself to think of something else. He tried several things, finally settling on an image of Natalie. From there, his mind drifted to other things, and 10 minutes later, he fell into a deep, dark sleep. Chapter 5. When Harvath awoke, it was once again to a mental picture of Natalie. Perhaps it was because she was gently knocking on his door. With only one stop for refueling, they had made the entire trip in less than 10 hours. After dressing, Harvath availed himself of the courtesy vanity kit in the lav to brush his teeth and clean up. When he stepped out, Natalie had a meal ready for him. He was able to get through only half of it before the pilot announced that they needed to prepare for landing and would be on the ground shortly. He grabbed a couple more bites and then thanked Natalie as she cleared everything away. Looking out the window, he was surprised to see the sun almost in the same place as when they had left Kenya. It was amazing how traveling backward across time zones, especially in such a fast aircraft, could make it seem like the day had stood absolutely still. Equally amazing was the fact that they were landing at Reagan National Airport and not Dulles International. The only international corporate jet flights allowed to land at Reagan were those originating at foreign airports with U.S. Customs and Border Protection pre-clearance facilities. Mombasa definitely didn't qualify. Whoever had arranged this flight had a lot of pull somewhere. Once they had landed and the plane had taxied to a stop, the crew assembled at the door to say goodbye to their passenger. As Harvath thanked them, the co-pilot handed him a small gift box.
"A souvenir from your flight," he said.
Looking inside, Harvath found a detailed display model of the Ariane SBJ, right down to this aircraft's signature paint job.
"Thank you," he replied.
"And you won't want to forget this," Natalie added, handing him the vanity kit from the lav.
Unlike his mother, as well as many of the women he had dated, Harvath wasn't a travel-size guy. He didn't keep hotel soaps or shampoos, nor did he keep the complimentary vanity kits when traveling first class. That said, he didn't want to hurt Natalie's feelings, and so accepted the kit with a smile and a thank you. He could toss it once he was off the plane. After he'd cleared customs and passport control, a courtesy vehicle picked him up for the short drive over to Signature Flight Support. It was a fixed-base operator facility, where he'd have a chance to clean up before one of his Carlton Group colleagues drove him into D.C. for his meeting with the old man. As he arrived at the FBO, he saw that it was one of Carlton's protégés, Sloane Ashby, who had been sent there to pick him up. Leaning against her car with her high cheekbones, smoky gray eyes, and hair pulled back in a ponytail, she looked like the country club wife of some handsome young banker. It would be a mistake, though, to judge this book by its cover. Sloane was not only brilliant, having graduated at the top of her class from Northwestern University with a dual major in math and chemistry, she was also highly skilled as a winter athlete, having competed in both figure skating and snowboarding. She was also one hell of an operator. As a former member of the U.S. freestyle ski team, Harvath told his colleagues that what he liked most about her was her prowess in winter sports, but none of them believed him. They all assumed what he liked about her was that she was hot. In other words, even people trained to know better still fell prey to the mistake of judging her solely by what they saw on the surface. Carlton, on the other hand, had very different reasons for liking her. In addition to admiring her academic and athletic abilities, he respected her because, despite her family's ability to cover all of her college expenses, she had insisted on paying her own way and had rocketed through the ROTC program. She had signed up, insisting that she be promised combat duty. She went on to complete 2 tours in Afghanistan, killing more enemy combatants than all of the women in the theater combined, not to mention many of the men. But when some glossy magazine ran an unauthorized cover story on her, it placed a huge bullseye on her back and brought her combat career to a screeching halt. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda were both offering big rewards for her head on a pike, and the Department of Defense had no other choice but to deny her request for a 3rd tour. Without missing a beat, and as bold as brass, she requested to be sent immediately to Iraq before all the action ended there. She was turned down, though, once again. She ended up being detailed to North Carolina's Fort Bragg, where she worked with the all-female Delta Detachment known as the Athena Project. Despite her young age, she was an excellent instructor. Everyone knew, though, that her heart and her talent lay in being an operator. She was quite vocal about the fact that if it weren't for the Islamic bounty on her head and the subsequent PR nightmare her capture or killing would cause, she'd still be out whacking and stacking Muslim terrorists